So today on the podcast, we talked about several things, including, I think, one of the best sports segments of all time.
Glenn Beck Talks Sports!
Yes. You were on fire, actually, on that segment. That was actually really good.
Because it wasn't about sports. It's all about common sense.
Right.
It's all about common sense. So we'll talk about sports. I'd like to tell you who the stories are about, but I don't remember his name or her name. One's a basketball player. One's a...
Baseball player.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I guess they're both in the news now. But also, we're going to talk about something else that's in the news that nobody's talking about, and that is the promise to sacrifice a red heifer, the 10th red heifer, in Israel in the next few days. Whether it happens or not, we don't know. We've seen the altar that has been built, but whether this is true or not, they say the sacrifice of the 10th red heifer is the one that begins the Messianic era. Whether that happens or not, it doesn't really matter, because if it does happen, if they do sacrifice this red heifer, the Middle East will melt down. We have that and so much more on today's program.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
So I don't know if you saw this. You remember the guy who, Yuri Berliner, who came out and wrote that article about NPR?
It's a fascinating story. Yes, I do remember this.
Fascinating, right?
With the Free Press, Barry Weiss's Free Press.
Yeah, and he came out and he said, you know, we have lost our journalistic integrity at NPR. And he still works there. Well, he worked there.
Incredible.
Unbelievable. He's a senior business editor at NPR. He said that the liberal bias had tainted its coverage of important stories, that we've always leaned liberal. He said, but we've lost our way on journalistic integrity. So NPR has suspended him.
Incredible.
Yeah.
So. It's funny, with all this talk of tolerance, they couldn't tolerate single person who said they were too liberal.
Well, he didn't ask permission to say bad things.
That's fine, especially from NPR. You know, there's that whole ombudsman tradition,
where
like you're supposed to be able to take this criticism.
Yes.
Like, even though most businesses, like if I was working at McDonald's or, you know, I'm working at Burger King, I wouldn't want my employees being out there saying negative things about my hamburgers. But like, there's a tradition in journalism that you're supposed to have the freedom of speech, freedom of the press, these things combining together into one to give employees who really see a problem an okay to speak out.
Well, this is the only press thing that you could say, freedom of the press, because they were fired from the inside. But these are government employees. This is all funded by the United States government and people like you. Mm.
Not like me.
I don't like those
I've
people.
Never given them
I don't.
A dime.
Yeah, I don't really want to even talk to those people. I don't know who those people are, and
the
I don't.
Herb and Emily Schmiminitz Foundation. You don't like them,
really?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's usually...
No. Herb is really not a good guy.
You don't like Herb?
No, I don't. I don't.
It's not
don't.
Herb, by the way. It's Herb.
Herb.
Herb and Emily Schmiminitz Foundation.
The Schmiminitz themselves are good, but I digress. So anyway. He came out and it was published, and the new chief executive, Kathleen Marr, came under new scrutiny because, you know, she's been an activist for a long time. So people start going through her stuff, series of year-old social media posts criticizing President Donald J. Trump and embracing progressive causes. Okay. NPR said that's unfair. Unfair. Oh, my gosh. That was unfair because her social media posts were written long before she was named chief executive at NPR, and that she wasn't working in the news industry at the time. NPR said also that while she managed the business side of a nonprofit, she was not involved in its editorial process. And she said in a statement, "In America, everyone's entitled to free speech as a private citizen." And you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But doesn't that go, if they hired this person with outrageous tweets showing her unbelievable progressive bent and hatred for Donald Trump.
To a comical level, by the way.
What do you...
The tweets are legitimately like parodies of liberals. Like, they're so over the top. At one point, She says, you know, I love Hillary Clinton, but I really wish she would stop using the terms boy and girl because they are very, I can't remember, basically like
sexist, misogynist.
Yeah, but yeah, like making people who are don't fit into one of those neat categories, they make them feel bad. And it's like exclusionary, I might have been the word she used. Like it was something like that. And it's like, that is like, you so like, if Saturday Night Live was funny, that would be the joke they would make.
Correct.
Right? Like,
correct.
Don't call girls and boys. You can't use those terms. She was the one using them. She was this, and this is like 2018 and 19 before it was cool.
So she's very, very left wing.
Insanely.
Now, if she is the head of the network, well, then you could imagine who she hired and what her principles and practices are. Several NPR employees have urged the network leaders to more forcefully renounce Mr. Berliner's claims in his essay. Edith Chapman, NPR's top editor, said in a statement last week that managers strongly disagree with his assessment of the quality of our journalism, adding the network is proud to stand behind its work. Some employees have begun to speak out. Tony Cavan, NPR's managing editor for Standards and Practices, well, they have that, took issue with many of Mr. Berliner's claims in an interview with The Times on Tuesday, saying Mr. Berliner's essay mischaracterized NPR's coverage of crucial stories. He said NPR's coverage of COVID-19, one of the lines of reporting that Mr. Berliner criticized, was in step with reporting from other mainstream news organizations at the time.
Yeah, we said they all sucked.
Right.
Right? The fact that you copied the other people who suck is nothing you should be bragging
about. May I just point out, NPR, if everyone was jumping off a bridge, does it make it right for you to jump off a bridge? I mean, they're saying, what? We're just doing what everybody else is doing.
Right.
I was just following orders. That doesn't work out well.
It's kind of where it was. Like, our accusation at the time was, all you guys are doing this groupthink thing where you're not actually considering the facts of these situations and all the other considerations like personal liberty that should factor into these decisions. And we said, all of you are doing it. Mm-hmm. And their defense is, but all of us were doing it.
I know. It's crazy. He also defended NPR's coverage of the Russian interference. I love this one. In the 2016 U.S. election, another area Mr. Berliner focused on, noting that Robert Mueller, the special counsel investigating the issue, concluded that Russian state actors had made attempts to sway the election.
Well, yes, they did make attempts to sway the election.
Donald that's Trump.
Right.
It
like,
was
that's not,
Donald not
the
Trump.
Tone of the coverage.
We talked
about this endlessly, that yes, Russia was trying to cause chaos here.
Of course Russia is.
That's
true. We were saying it before it was cool to say it.
Right. But we also said, wait a minute, you think Donald Trump is a Russian agent since 1984? Like, remember they were saying things like that at the time?
Yeah.
And now I don't know if that one was NPR. That was somebody else. But still, this is the tone of the coverage. And again, their defense is, well, we were all doing it. Like, you know... I was going to go down and expand your analogy, and I'm rethinking it right now. So I'm going to go ahead, reverse ground, and instead say the media is doing a bad job.
Right. We're all following orders here. Cavan also pointed out that NPR had no way to verify early articles about Hunter Biden's laptop. Oh, my gosh. Oh, you had plenty of ways to verify. You had plenty.
They have no,
you
no
said,
contacts within the FBI, Glenn. The NPR,
they have none.
They couldn't
none.
Have tried to.
The FBI's on the phone with everybody lying to you again. The same people that lied to you before are lying to you again. And you're like, I got this liar on the phone who's been lying to us the whole time. And, you know, we've been stuck out by him several times. But he says it's absolutely a plant. Oh, well, then we got to stop investigating everything. We're not even going to bring it up on NPR because we don't repeat lies.
It's incredible. I mean, and because of their irrelevance at some level, NPR gets a pass on their coverage of that. A lot of times we will bring up, we're guilty of this, saying, oh, the New York Times didn't do this and the Washington Post didn't do this. And it's true. However, NPR was probably the worst. They were literally mocking the idea that the Hunter Biden laptop could possibly be true.
They've never come back and said, here's how we failed.
Right.
Instead, they say, well, everybody else was doing it.
Yeah. And now they're suspending the people that pointed it out.
Yeah.
Like, it's
I was just wearing my party pin. That's all.
No. You don't need to expand.
I'm just...
It was a nice...
What?
It was a focused point. I've rethought expanding the analogy. Why wouldn't you? We're all doing it, Glenn. But my point here is, I think NPR escaped a lot of the worst of the criticism when they deserved the worst. And then when they get the criticism from their own ranks, they just suspend the guy. I mean, it's comical. It's comical. It's like these organizations don't even attempt to hide it anymore, Glenn. And I think that is, you could say there's been liberal bias forever. And of course, that's true. But the change has been the fact that they don't even try to hide it anymore.
It's not that they don't hide it. It's as if they don't see it. They are so...
It's hard to believe.
They are so part of Big Brother's plan that they don't even understand that they're part of the Ministry of Truth. It is incredible. It's not that they're not hiding it. They don't see it anymore. They don't see what's right in front of their face. And they don't want to.
It doesn't seem like they do. I mean, so as soon as it's pointed out to them, they just run from it. And this is like, you know, you can make mistakes. I may be out on a limb on this, on talk radio, but like, I don't think it was crazy to be skeptical of the Hunter Biden laptop story. It's in a freaking bonkers story. The son of the president dropped off his laptop at a blind guy's repair shop.
We didn't
and left
pick it
there.
Up right away.
I mean, I can when understand we, being yeah, skeptical of that story.
I believe we were skeptical on day one. We were like, come on, this is too good to be true.
I remember thinking, I think the laptop is... there was enough there for me to think it might have been real, but I was very skeptical of the story of how they came across it.
Correct.
It felt like maybe someone inside the Biden household campaign like leaked it to them.
Kind of like the diary.
Right, yeah. Like it seemed like some other chain of custody, if you will. But like, I mean, look, the son of the president got so coked up, he dropped his laptop with all of his... prostitute and drug pictures off at a blind guy's repair shop who then got it to Rudy Giuliani 8 days before the election. There is a reason to be skeptical of that story. Like that is completely insane.
Yes.
However, it is your job, especially when the nation's oldest newspaper is the one reporting it as fact, it is your job to go in there and take it seriously and try to figure out what the hell is going on.
No, not if you have somebody from the government who has been known to lie to you over and over and over again and been wrong
over and over again.
It's you can't continue. You've got to take that liar's word for it, because this time he might be telling the truth.
Right.
I mean, that is their logic. Yeah. That is their logic. I know this guy has stuck us out over and over and over again, but maybe this time he's right, and this time we got him.
Yeah, that's the part that does surprise me a little bit, because I'm not surprised they're going to favor left-wing ideals. I'm not surprised they're going to be liberals. I'm not surprised at any of that. I am surprised that when these people come and progressives.
Thank you.
I am surprised when you put yourself out on a limb to say this person's telling us the truth, it backfires in your face and you don't get angry.
But right now, there's no consequence.
I guess there's no backfire, right?
Has anybody's Pulitzer Prize been taken away?
They've been handing them out as much, it seems like.
Right. Nobody for the Russiagate stories that the New York Times, I think they still have their Pulitzer Prize for it. So there is no consequence yet. There will be at some point. There is actually in your ratings and your revenues, but... there's no consequence yet from the industry, from the people you care about. I'm still getting the award.
That's true. And there are consequences that come down the road eventually.
Yeah.
Mainly in the eternal resting place. So
are you saying they're all going to hell?
I mean, who am I to judge?
Yeah.
But yes.
But yeah. Okay, good. Thank you. All right. Back in just a second.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck Program.
First, let me ask you a question. Do you have your phone bill auto draft right out of your account every month? And if so, is part of the reason because you don't want to actually see how high that bill is. Maybe you're also, it's a little easier if you're not reminded of who the money is going to. Why not solve both issues by switching to Patriot Mobile? They share your values. They're America's only Christian conservative wireless provider. Their mission is to passionately defend our God-given constitutional rights and freedoms and to glorify God always. And they do that by offering dependable nationwide coverage that you can access on any three major networks that everybody is on. So you're going to get the same great coverage. But you don't have to worry that part of your bill is going to fund leftist causes. They offer affordable, excellent plans, 100% U.S.-based customer service team. They'll help you make switching easy for you, whether you're keeping your number, your phone, or upgrading one or both. Just go to patriotmobile.com/Beck or call 972-PATRIOT. 972-PATRIOT. Get free activation when you use the offer code Beck. Join me and make the switch today. It's patriotmobile.com/Beck. patriotmobile.com/Beck or 972-PATRIOT. Now back to the podcast. All right, so we were talking about the Palestinians that are, well, let's show them again. Here they are on the Golden Gate Bridge. Hassling people who are getting out of their car, and they're like, I'm just trying to get home!
Okay, so it's surrounding a guy in a way that is borderline illegal. I mean, you have to let people pass, right? Like, I mean, certainly the blocking of the road is illegal, but you're surrounding an individual.
But is it illegal? Is anybody, where are the police? If it's illegal, where are the police? They should have them stationed at the bridge. There should be bridge police.
Right. Like when you know these things are going on, you get police there and remove these people immediately.
Immediately.
And you push.
Oh, what a surprise. That's what's happening in Florida. And you what? I heard the word push.
You know, again, that was another sentence. Okay. That was an edited sentence.
Okay.
You heard the editing in real time. Right. I'm just thinking of the location of where you are is at a top of a bridge. And that's
okay.
I had a all thought and I stopped hearing the thought.
Here are these protesters in Chicago blocking the way to Chicago O'Hare. And they got the drums too, so it's even better.
Even more annoying.
Yeah. And people are just getting out of their cars and they are just walking in the median, dragging their suitcases behind them.
I
hate them.
All I'd want to do is support Israel.
Yeah.
Like the rest of my days would be spent giving money to just the IDF directly.
You know what? They should do that. They should have IDF soldiers
just
right
with Venmo scans just standing there.
Want to give to us?
Yeah.
Want to give to us? Okay. So anyway,
that's a great fundraising tool.
It is. It is. So we were talking about it, and then Stu revealed something that I had never heard before that happened on the train as he went from the New Jersey side to Manhattan every day, an hour and a half. He would take a train to go do the show there. And now we worked there for 5-6 years,
something like that. Yeah.
And I've never heard this story, which is when you hear the story, kind of interesting that I never heard it.
Because it wasn't a story. It happened often. You know, I would say every between 4 to 6 months, you'd be on the train commute and you're going, you know, 80 miles an hour or 70 miles an hour down the train, you know, and you're mindlessly staring at your laptop with all sorts of weird smells of cultures you don't recognize all around you.
Oh, man. What a
wafting through your nostrils. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, the train would stop, and you just roll your, oh, no, what's going on now? And you don't know what it is. It could be a stupid delay in the tracks. There could be traffic. There could be a technical issue. There's all these different things it could be. And some of them mean you stop for 2 minutes, and they keep moving. Some of them mean it could be hours. And then you get the news filters its way down the train car to train car, and you find out that, no, this time it's one of those times where someone has decided they want to kill themselves and have jumped out in front of the train, have killed themselves. Now the train is stopped. We cannot move because the police have to come and investigate this person who's killed themselves.
I just want to point out, this is a different, anybody wants to know what it's like living in New York City, right there. Yep. And it's not that story. It's the fact that he never once came in to work and said, oh, jeez, man.
Gosh, the worst thing happened.
Worst thing happened. Yeah. Somebody killed themselves.
No.
He would be late and he would just say, trains.
Yeah.
That's all he would say. Mm-hmm. Trains. He would never say, somebody jumped in front of our train and killed themselves.
You wonder why some of the people in the media are dead inside. This is part of it. It really is. Like, just living in that city, it makes you have all sorts of calculations of like, hey, this person who was obviously mentally ill and probably is going to go murder someone, started abusing some woman on the train. Rats crawled on over my leg on the way in. Like, you have all these weird things that you do, and you justify as normal living in this place. And that was one of the things. And by the way, the reaction was never like a solemn, oh my gosh, what was that person going through? And I started thinking about that in the concept of the conversation about the Palestinian protesters, because the conversation of the people in the cars is not, gosh, maybe the Palestinians have a point here. Maybe Gaza really does need to be free. It's like, these people are the worst people on earth. I hate their cause. I hate everything about them. I want to get home. And when we were on the train, that was the same thing. Like, all right, the body can't still be on the tracks, right? So, like, let's just keep going and we'll tell the police where it was. They can come look at it.
Is this a new thing? Or when people were crossing the mountains, you know, with the wagon trains and poor old Jebediah, you know, dropped dead halfway through.
Sure.
Were there people in the wagon train where they're like, it's Jebediah, he was going to die anyway, let's keep going.
Right.
Let's keep going. And everybody was like, no, we've got to stop and pray and bury him properly. Were there people that were like, come on?
They're like, you know, I mean, look, Jebediah's six-year-old daughter died a few miles back, and he was fine leaving her behind. We got to leave. It would be what Jebediah wanted for us to keep rolling through the mountains.
He wanted us to get to the other side quickly before the snow came. I think this is a rather modern thing. Maybe it's not.
It's cold, and it's, you know, it's somewhat cold. But it's also somewhat understandable, I will say, in the moment. Like, because, look, you're living your life. And, like, it felt, you know what it felt like? I'll be honest with you. On the train, it felt selfish. It was like, you could have jumped off a bridge. And no one, and it would have been sad for the family the same way. Would have been sad for you the same way. But it wouldn't have stopped us from getting home to see our families. And that is how, I know it sounds really cold and dark, but that's how every person on the train thought about it.
Okay, so now I have a worse story than you that I've never told you, okay? And this happened probably 20 years ago. And there's been a lot of shame on with this story.
Really?
Okay? Yeah. I felt bad about it. Well, not so bad, but I felt bad enough to not share the story.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because I was... I mean, I think I was just surrounded by monsters. It wasn't me. It was the other monsters.
It was the other people there.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure it
They're
was.
The bad ones.
So my wife and I, we were in Brussels or some godforsaken place over in Europe. And we're over there and we didn't have the best of times. And we were flying back and the plane was really late. And I'm like... And we're landing in New York City, so that doesn't make, you know, it's not like, hey, you got a prize at the end. And
it's direct from Brussels to New York?
Direct from Brussels to New York. So you know there's probably all those French politicians, Europeans on board. So you don't want to talk to anybody anyway. So we're sitting there, and I just keep seeing, you know, they show you the little airplane, and you're like, oh, look, it's only 14 million hours before we get home. And so I'm calculating in my head by the time we get out of traffic, and we get, it's gonna be like 4 a.m. by the time we get home, and I got to be at work at 6. And we are flying over London. We get past London, and we hear, boom. Is there a doctor on board?
Uh-oh.
Oh, boy.
That's never a good sign. It's better than, is there a pilot on board? It's better than that one.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Okay, so is there a doctor on board? Okay, so everybody starts looking around, and I see this guy about 3 seats behind us, and the stewardesses are all around him, and he's clearly dead. Clearly.
So there
dead.
Was no, was there a struggle?
I think happened? He had a heart attack,
okay.
You know, and just kind of like, you know, went down. And,
wow.
Yeah. And so a doctor comes and he's doing the chest compressions and everything. They're not bringing him back. Okay. He's dead. They ask everybody in the row to move. All the people in the row are all standing there. Now, they're in business class, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I understand, you know, you got to lay him down flat and you're going to try to, but he's dead, okay?
Right, right.
He doesn't care if he sits in the back row. You know, you can't get the seats back, you know what I mean? He's dead.
Right.
He's dead.
Like, he doesn't care about the bathroom smell.
No,
right.
He doesn't care.
He doesn't care.
Doesn't care.
That's true.
All right? But they ask everybody else in that row to move. And I start feeling bad for the people in the rest of the...
But you're not feeling bad for the dead guy. You're feeling bad for the people
in the row.
No, I'm
feeling bad for the people. I'm like, wow, they paid a lot of money for that. Yeah. And they're going to go back, sit in the last row with the bathrooms.
Wow.
And then I hear, bing. Oh, this is your captain. We've had a... incident on board, nothing to worry about, but looks like we'll be heading back to London to land. Now, you have a choice at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You have a choice. You have a choice of, well, he's dead and we should get him to
a
morgue or whatever as soon as we can. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other choice. He's dead.
Mm.
There's 500 of us up here that are not dead. And have to continue on with our lives, okay? Now, I don't want to sound completely callous. Because my wife was next to me, we prayed for him, mm-hmm. and we prayed for his family. Mm-hmm. Not to say my heart was entirely in it at the time. I might have added, and please don't turn the plane around.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't. So they're flying, and we're thinking, oh, come on, you... I mean, what are the odds? He took off in Brussels. He's landing in New York. The chance that he's from London.
Oh, it's like 0%.
Zero. Right. So why lock his body up in a third country and then have to worry?
Wait a minute. Seems like you're rationalizing a little bit.
Why would you do that? And so then finally, it goes on and we're getting further and further away from London. We're over the Atlantic now. And I know they're looking and, you know, they got a tape measure out or whatever they do up front. And they're like, which is it closer to London or should we go all the way?
Yeah, it's all tape measure.
It's all tape measure. And so they find it. Bing. Ladies and gentlemen, we have decided that we are indeed going to land in New York. We're not turning back to London. And a cheer went up.
Wait, the crowd cheered?
Crowd cheered.
It seems a little cold. Did you cheer?
Oh, no, that would have been wrong.
Oh, okay.
Not outwardly.
Right. Okay.
You know.
You kept that inside.
And it would have been a little worse. I'm not sure they could have seen his body as clearly as I could.
So these people are in the back. The peons who could not afford business class are in the back.
Sure.
And they're cheering.
They're cheering.
So, but that's...
But I would expect that. That's why you keep a curtain between those people and the business class.
There you go.
We might be thinking the same thing, but we're certainly not going to outwardly.
Now, was there... Was there a thought that because they're cheering, they don't know this person's dead. They just heard there's an incident and we're going to keep going.
Well,
they don't necessarily
know. It's spread.
Know. Okay, yeah, but
it's kind of like the train.
Okay, so you're not giving them any exemption.
No, it's spread. No, it's spread. We all knew what was going on.
Now that's pretty dark.
Yeah.
Because you were thinking about where you're going to land.
Right.
Which is.
And that's why I said
pretty
for 20
dark.
Years I haven't said this out loud because it's shameful.
Instead of thinking of the dead person and their family, you were thinking about how do I get home faster? And like, yes, of course, we can just transport this carcass all the way to New York City.
Right. And the odds are his family's there.
That's a justification. I'm not going to give you any points for that. You just thought about afterward. Okay.
It's probably a pretty good shot.
Was there a moment, and this is going to be tough to be honest on, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Was there a moment that you thought, we're in business class. Like, should the body be with the coach people? Was there a moment you thought of that?
No.
Okay, good.
No, but I did think the body should be with the coach people, not because they're in coach, but because the other people paid for those seats, and now they're sitting back by the bathrooms, and that's just not right.
Yeah.
He's dead.
He doesn't care.
He's dead.
Put him in the worst seat.
I'm not saying treat him with disrespect, but he took up a whole row.
Of business class.
Business class. I mean, he took up a whole row. That wasn't right. That just wasn't right.
I mean, I feel like if you're already in one of the back rows of coach, you've kind of made a deal. You might be next to a corpse. I feel like that's part of the ticket. You know, like when you do that, they're like, there might be a corpse next to you.
A lot of times they treat you like that.
Yes.
You know, it's like, Shut up, dead man. You kind of feel that way. Here, you want some nuts? Here's a bag of nuts. So now I'm only bringing this up
in hopes
that people who are shutting down the bridges and the highways to the airports for whatever godforsaken thing. I really don't care. I don't care if you're like, Jesus loves us, and you've got the drum and you're like, Jesus loves everybody. Jesus loves everybody. If you stop people going to the airport, if you stop people from going home after a hard night, nobody's going to hear that. Nobody. Nobody's going to listen. Mm. And how do I know? Because I've been on a plane with 500 people that cheered when we weren't going to drop the dead guy off.
It's sad that you brought this story up after the finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm, because it would have made a great episode of that show. That would have been incredible.
I did feel a little like Larry David.
Yeah,
I did
feel it's very Larry David.
Yeah.
You are listening to the best of Glenn Beck. To listen to the rest of this interview, check out the full show podcast.
Have you ever noticed how every time you go to buy meat in the grocery store these days, the price tag is just a little higher, but the package feels a little lighter at the same time? It's weird, isn't it? In this inflation-riddled economy, one of the best things you can do for yourself and your family is to lock down the price of things when and where you can. If you think the price of meat is high today, just wait. You can do this now and lock in your price with Good Ranchers. Right now, during their April Price Shield sale, not only are you getting delicious 100% American beef, chicken, pork, wild-caught seafood here in America, but if you subscribe during the month of April, you'll also lock in your price until 2026. I can't even imagine what the price of meat will be in 2026, plus 10% off with the promo code BECK. Always assuming Jesus hasn't come back before then, when the price of meat will probably be different. Prices may vary. The price on meat, you can lock it in to 2026, and it could save you a ton of money. With this exclusive price shield offer ending at the end of April, you want to secure the best price on meat until 2026 right now. Go to goodranchers.com. Use the promo code BECK. That's goodranchers.com. Use the promo code BECK. Save 10% off your subscription and lock in your price. The price lock guarantee until 2026. Goodranchers.com. American meat delivered. Now back to the podcast. Bill Cloud is with us. He's from Shorshim Ministries. He's the founder of that and Jacob's Tenth Fellowship founder. Welcome to the program, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
Very good. It's good to have you on again. So
good to be here.
Tell me the red heifer thing. I heard back in the 90s, I think it was, people were talking about the red heifer that, you know, they're rare, but I think there was an American farm, maybe Florida. I can't remember. That had a bunch of red heifers, and they sent them over to Israel. Is that right?
It was from Mississippi. Was the farm? Anyway, okay. I don't remember that. But anyway, it was back in the late 90s, 97, and there was one red heifer. They even named her Melody, and I think they put her on the cover of Newsweek or Time or something like that. But anyway, you know, it created a big stir about the red heifer, and the red heifer is connected to the idea of the possibility of a rebuilt temple. And so, yeah, there was a lot of chatter back as far back as the late 90s. So
there's been 9 red heifers that have been sacrificed since Moses, and that's to purify the temple?
Well, the red heifer is basically, thematically, it's the antidote for the golden calf. The golden calf is, you know, about rebellion, death. Moses has that ground into powder, mixes it with water, the people drink it, that identifies who's guilty, death. The red heifer, it's burned, the ashes are collected, it's mixed with spring water or pure water, and then those who've been contaminated, and particularly with, you know, contact with something that is dead, you're purified and you're cleansed ceremonially. And so the idea is that you can approach God, where before with the golden calf, I'm not going to go with these people. If I go with them, I'll have to kill them. They're so stubborn. But then he made allowances. And so it is for ceremonial cleansing in order to approach God. So that's important in relation to the rebuilding of a temple, because they don't have a temple at this point. Religious Jews see the temple as the manifestation of God's presence on earth. They want to be able to approach God in that regard. And so the ashes of a red heifer with the waters of purification are essential if things are going to be cleansed, the temple mount, all the utensils, all the implements that go into the sanctuary, and the people who go up to the temple mount.
Okay, so
in a nutshell,
I think it was on the 100th day anniversary of October 7th, Hamas came out and they talked about really the red heifer and said that the Jews are going to start purifying the temple mount, and you know, this is an act of war, and they knew exactly what the red heifer meant. But we've had a red heifer before. Why did they not use that red heifer and make that the 10th? And why is this one supposedly the 10th?
Well, the one that I referred to from 97, you know, they were watching it, but it actually grew some hairs that were, you know, of a different color, because this red heifer has to be entirely red. There can't be hairs of a different color, which is, you know, why it would make it so rare.
Right.
So my understanding is, at this point, among these red heifers, they feel like they have some that are still qualified, you know, that would be eligible to be, you know, slaughtered and burned, et cetera. So, as far as the Muslim world, and particularly, you know, the likes of Hamas and Hezbollah and people like that, that's going to get them up in arms. And so that's I would say that's what makes it a little different, is that they're reportedly, among these red heifers, some that they feel are qualified to be slaughtered for that purpose.
And they've already built the ramp, I guess, to the altar, and they've built an altar, which I don't know if that's been done before. And they're claiming that before the Passover, somewhere, you know, around this time, that they're going to slaughter the heifer and burn the heifer ceremonially, correct?
Well, from what I understand, well, let me backtrack just a minute. An altar, there were people who had built, quote unquote, altars in times past to make a statement, a political statement. I mean, 667, religious Jews have been pushing to rebuild a temple. Mm-hmm. In 1990, I was in Jerusalem at the Western Wall, and a group that wants to see the temple rebuilt came in with what they said was going to be the cornerstone of the temple. And it was symbolic. It was a protest. It was saying, hey, we're here. We're going to push for this. So through the years, there have been different things that have happened. And it seems to me it's particularly around the time of Passover when you hear all this chatter, and also in the fall feast around the Feast of Tabernacles. So as far as this altar, I've heard rumors. I haven't seen anything that's absolutely verified. But here's the issue. If a group of people have red heifers and even go so far as to slaughter it and burn the ashes, is that going to be accepted by the, you know, the greater religious community?
Right.
That's uncertain, frankly.
Yeah, because so, who has the authority to do it?
Well, that's just it. You know, it's entirely possible, and I want to underscore that word possible, that the group that is pushing this right now, who have these heifers, if there is one that they deem to be qualified to be slaughtered and burned, okay, so they do that. Is the greater religious community going to regard that and accept it? Here's another issue. What about the Israeli government? I tend to think they're going to frown very much.
Yeah, very much so.
So you could have ashes. They could do it. They could have ashes that are just sitting there. Point being, is just because you have a red heifer, and I'm not saying that's unimportant, but just because you have a red heifer, and even if they burn it, which is when I'll perk up and take notice, even then, if you have the ashes, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to start next week in rebuilding the temple.
Right.
Because if they burn a red heifer, Glenn, everybody's going to hear about it, including the Muslim world, including the Israeli government. That would be a provocation. Now, one day it's going to happen, but is it now? Who knows?
So, Bill, the people who are doing it are the people from the Temple Institute, who, from what I understand, I was over there. I talked to some of them while I was over there last couple of times, they say they have everything that is required to rebuild the temple. They say if the temple, if it could be cleared so they could build it, they have everything they need to build it, except for the red heifer at the time, you know, and permission to go up on the Temple Mount and build it. Is that true? Do they have everything?
That's what I was told years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, for years, the Temple Institute has been, you know, creating the garments for the priests, all the different utensils, all the different furnishings. And I mean, this is going back 15 years or more, you know, when I was there at the Temple Institute
right.
visiting, they said, yeah, we've got all of those things. The only thing that they didn't have was, you know, the Ark of the Covenant. And as you said, you know, there was an eligible red heifer for the waters of purification. So I think, you know, they're very, very motivated to see the temple rebuilt. But I believe that they also realize that it's not just getting everything together and boom, here we go. There's a lot of things that are going to have to be considered.
So what has to, we've made a lot of progress, and these things could take 1,000 years to check off the last couple. And it could happen tomorrow. You never know. How far down the line are we on the known prophecy of the things that have to happen before, you know, the clock starts ticking for the return of Christ?
Well, I think the clock has already started ticking. Now, let me say this. When it comes to Bible prophecy and being fulfilled, it is my experience that it almost never happens the way we think it's going to happen. It just always happens the way it's written. And then when it happens, we go, oh, that's what he meant, you know. So it doesn't happen necessarily according to our interpretation. It happens the way God says it's going to happen. So that being understood, here's Bill's opinion. Now, when seasons change, the weather changes. And every spring in our part of the country, and you're familiar with it there in Texas as well, when springtime comes around, you know, you have the potential for violent weather. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we get severe thunderstorm watches, but then if the conditions, you know, worsen, then it can become a warning. My opinion is this constitutes a thunderstorm watch. It doesn't mean that we're under a warning. It doesn't mean it's necessarily imminent. Now, things can change tomorrow, as you said, and all bets are off and everything's going really fast.
And when you say that this is a warning, not a watch, you're talking about the red heifer.
I'm thinking that the presence of red heifers constitutes, if I can put it this way, you know, we're under a thunderstorm watch, not a warning.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that the rebuilding of a temple is imminent. It means that there are people in the land of Israel who want to see that happen. They've been working toward that. They've been preparing for that. They're going to have everything in place when the time is right, at least in their eyes. And can I say this as well? You know, sometimes the Bible describes things that, the Bible prescribes, you know, God said, don't eat the fruit of that tree. Mm-hmm. And then the Bible describes what people do. And they ate the fruit of that tree. And so the Bible does talk about there being a temple in the last days. But does that mean that God sanctions it? Or does it mean that people pushed for it? And that's a big difference. And so that's why I say our interpretation sometimes, things don't happen the way we think it's going to happen. But back to your question, where are we? I do believe we're in the last days, and I do believe the Messiah is returning. Is he going to return in my lifetime? I don't know. Nobody knows that. So in that vein, I want to make sure that I'm focusing on all the things that he said were important. And with all due respect, he didn't say, okay, be on the watch for a red heifer. he didn't. I mean, I'm not
right.
trying to demean the role a red heifer will play as it relates to the end days, but that's not what he said to be on the lookout for. What he said was, you need to be careful that no one deceives you. You need to be aware of, in the last days, the lawlessness in the world is going to become so pervasive that if it were possible, even the very elect would be carried away by it. And it's going to be so bad that some people are just going to give up. They're just going to quit their faith. And so these are the things that he said that you and I need to be aware of. So, you know, sometimes, and I want to be very careful how I say this, because, you know, I've taught prophecy for, you know, 30 plus years. I believe in Bible prophecy. I believe that God says these things and they will happen according to his will. But sometimes we can get so focused on what we think is going to happen or what we want to happen that we can lose sight of what God is actually doing and saying in this moment. And so I'm not ready to declare that because there are red heifers in Israel that there's going to be a third temple built, you know, right away. I don't know, but I'm not ready to say that. If they burn a red heifer, we're all going to hear about it, I guarantee you. And if they burn a red heifer, then I'll go, oh, okay, well, let's pay attention and see what happens now.
Right, because it can sit there for a long time. It doesn't doesn't mean that they have to build it. It's just one other thing off the checklist.
Right. You know, and things could be that way. And they could sit in, you know, limbo for a while. Or, you know, conditions can change. Iran can decide to do something like they did the other day and ramp it up. And people, you know, take that as an opportunity to do certain things. I mean, things can happen overnight. 9/11, you know, our world changed overnight. So I'm not going to discount that possibility. I'm just saying that for me, as far as this red heifer component of Bible prophecy, I'd say, okay, we have a thunderstorm watch. We just need to be watching and seeing what happens.
Okay.
And it doesn't necessarily mean it's imminent.
Bill, I'd love to have you back maybe tomorrow if you have time, because I'd like to talk to you about the relationship between Russia and Iran and what we're facing there, and if that plays a role in any of the things that we are supposed to be looking for. But also, you mentioned the Ark of the Covenant. You can't have the temple rebuilt without the Ark of the Covenant. And there seems to be some people that believe, don't worry, we know exactly where it is. Could I get you to come back on the program? Talk about those things?
Yes.
Great.
Sure. Just let me know when.
You got it. Thank you so much. Bill Cloud. You can follow him at his website, billcloud.org.